Now, my aim is, and I put to you, I aim to finish, not to go to 4 o'clock, but to finish mid-afternoon. So we'll have one session now and then one session after lunch, which gives you then time to get ready for the most important thing, which is the Gemütlichkeit. And if you need to go home early, if you need to travel, say, 4 or 5 is a bit late, I realise. And I think we're reaching close to saturation point. I don't know about you. Now, I want to spend the next period, this session, on God's institution of the divine service. And this is the heart and core of everything. Right? Now, every morning, every evening, the divine service is enacted by the priest on behalf of the people at the tabernacle and then later at the temple of Jerusalem. Okay? It's enacted morning and evening. On the Sabbath day, on festivals, it's the same service but augmented. The number of animals is increased, but basically it's the same service, the same template. And you need to distinguish between the public burnt offering and the private offerings. So you get the morning sacrifice or the morning offering, and we have great difficulty finding, or I have great difficulty finding getting terminology for this, because there is no one set of terminology in the Old Testament. So you have, in the morning, you've got the morning offering, and that's public. Focused, around before and after 9 o'clock. And then you have the evening or afternoon offering. And the focus here is on the offering of a lamb, a male lamb to God. So you have morning and evening, beginning, end of the day. And the space in between here, the two, is for personal offerings.
That's cool.
Okay, one of the things, the only way you can get your head around this is not abstractly, but to actually envisage it and see it, what's going on, to map it out. In the morning, the first thing the priest would do is to clear the altar, remove the ashes, put wood, get the coals that are still alive, and set the altar on fire to produce coals. Okay, so in the morning, you have the morning offering, and then you have the lamb and the cereal offering on the altar, producing a column of smoke. And what's important is that the personal offerings are placed on top of the lamb. So you have the public offering, personal offering, and then the day closes with a public offering once again. You get the basic sequence? Morning and evening. Now, in practical terms, this looks like, if you like, three sets of offerings, but in fact is one single enactment. These two sort of belong together. And basically, this is the same as that. So the day is closed with the public burnt offering. It begins with the public burnt offering and ends with the public burnt offering. Now, I don't have time to deal with these personal offerings, the offerings that the Israelites bring as in their families to the Lord. And the main offering with the personal offering are the so-called peace offerings or fellowship offerings. And the distinctive feature of these offerings is that only a small portion of the animal is burnt on the altar. But all the meat, the important stuff, is not burnt. The priests get part of the animal, basically the four quarters and the rib cage of the right hand of the animal. And the rest of the animal belongs to the person who brings the offerings. And they eat this as a holy meal. So peace offerings, fellowship offerings, are meal offerings. You bring them in order to have a holy meal with God. And you bring them in your families because this is a family meal that is held as God's guests at the temple. Now, what I'd like to do, first of all, before I look at God's institution of the divine service, is to map it out for you in broad outline, because otherwise it'll be a little bit confusing for you. Now, we have an expert on this here in our midst. Bob Machina is doing his doctorate on this. So if you want further data on this, you just email Bob and he'll fill you in.
He'll give you more information than you want to know.
No. But he'll also straighten you out. Now, okay, let me take you through the basic order of the daily offering. The term for the daily offering is ha-tamid. Ha-tamid. Tamid means always or regularly. Adverb, it's an adverb but it's a noun. It means a regular enactment, a regular ritual. A ritual that is not just enacted occasionally, but regularly. And regularly means morning and evening. Hatamid, the regular ritual. Now, the English translations of this are appalling. And you need to go to the Hebrew to get the exact sense of this. There's a whole tractate of them in the Mishnah. Now, the Jewish commentary on the priestly literature called the Tamid, which means the regular daily burnt offering. Okay, now let me take you through it, and you'll need to follow it because it's quite complex. As I said, the day begins with the priest. Oh, look, what I'll be going through is basically the morning sacrifice. Instead of standing there, I'll stand here. This is the morning sacrifice, okay? The priests on duty, the first thing they do is to clear the altar. From the previous day, the ashes have been heaped up over the coals that are still alive, and the ashes then keep the coals alive overnight. In the morning, the priests rake the ashes off the coals. They isolate the glowing coals with the eternal fire, the perpetual fire, and they remove the ashes, they remove the bones and other stuff from the previous day's offerings, and then they put wood on the altar, there's a big fire, and they produce coals. And the wood they use is hardwood, because softwood doesn't produce good coals. That's technically speaking not yet part of the divine service. It's preparation for the divine service. And I won't go into all the details, but then the second most important act of preparation is that in this northern part of the outer court, the priest on duty slaughters the male lamb, year-old male lamb, that is going to be presented to God as the morning offering. So every morning, every evening, you have a lamb that's being offered. Lamb is probably not quite right because it's not a little bitty thing, but it's a year-old sheep, lamb in that sense. So the lamb is slaughtered somewhere here, and the most significant thing is it's slaughtered in such a way that all the blood is drained from the meat. You don't break the neck because as soon as the neck is broken, the heart stops beating and there's still a lot of blood in the meat. So the carotid arteries, the main arteries here, are opened and the animal bleeds to death. The priests catch the blood in bowls and put them aside. Then the rest of the animal's dressed. I won't go into all the details. The important thing is that you have meat, you have the body of the animal, and you have the blood of the animal. So body and blood. Now, the first important ritual enactment is that the priest on duty stands probably at this corner and this corner of the altar and takes the blood from the lamb that's been slaughtered and splashes it against the side of the altar. Half the blood is splashed here on this side, and the other half is splashed on this side and this side. So all the blood from the animal is splashed against the altar. There's drainage things around the side of the altar to catch it and take it away if there's surplus. Now, the significance of this... No, okay. Wrong word. We go straight as modern Europeans say, what's the meaning of this? If you want to understand ritual, you don't ask the question, what does this mean, but what does this do? What does it accomplish? What does it accomplish for the people who are doing it? And then more importantly, what is God doing here? So this is not a kind of a teaching aid, you know, what does this mean? But this is a enactment. What does it do? Well, from a human point of view, the doing is that blood is splashed against the altar. Quite insignificant. But in fact, for anybody in the ancient world, and for many people, it means that the best part of the animal, the most nutritious part of the animal, is wasted. Okay? Blood, very significant. I haven't got time to go into it fully, but okay, the blood is splashed. Now, what does God do? And what does the priest do by doing this? This is the rite of atonement. But when the priest splashes the blood, he performs the rite of atonement. And God then says, as he's instituted the rite of atonement, as the means by which people and things are cleansed from impurity. And that means that if people are cleansed from their impurity, if they have sinned, they are forgiven. If they have been sinned against, they are cleansed. So the people, the whole community, the priest, and the sanctuary itself is cleansed from impurity. Now, why would this come first in the divine service in the Old Testament? Unless you are clean, unless you are righteous, unless you are pure, you can't, you could enter God. What would happen to you? You would come under the wrath of God. Okay? So this means that you can enter safely into the presence of God. You needn't be afraid of doing the next thing. So, first, the rite of atonement. That's number one. I won't go into the bits and pieces like vesting and all that kind of stuff because it gets too complicated. I want the big picture. After that's happened, then the priest who is on duty washes his hands and feet in the basin before entering the holy place. Now, why would he wash his feet? Because they're going barefoot. It's holy ground, therefore the feet have to be clean, richly clean. Now, this is holy water. The basin is most holy, the water is holy, and the holy water cleanses. I don't know if you like. The high priest baptizes his hands and his feet. Why does he baptize his hands?
Handling holy things.
He'll be handling holy things. Okay. That's preparatory. That's just not a main part of the ritual. Okay, but then he enters the holy place, and I won't go through all of it. In the morning and evening, attending to the lampstand, on the Sabbath, then attending to the showbread. But the most important thing he does there is very, very simple. He brings coals in a pan from here to here and puts the red hot burning coals on the altar. And then he has another container. We don't know what it's like. It's probably kind of a shovel. And so there's a shovel with coals, and there's a different kind of shovel which contains the most holy incense. The most holy incense. And he burns that incense here before the Lord. So the coals are put on the altar, the incense is put on the coals, and it means that the whole of the holy place is filled with this very, very pungent, powerful incense, and his whole vestments are filled with this very, very powerful smell, this aroma. He burns the incense. As he comes and does this, he wears the priestly regalia, and one of the most important things about the priestly regalia is that he bears the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on his shoulders and over his heart. So he carries the people on his shoulders, he carries the people on his heart into the presence of God, the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay. And then he comes out. Now, in practical terms, he goes in smelling like an ordinary human being. He comes out bringing the sweetness from God. He comes out bringing sweetness from God into the presence of the people. It's a bit like you women putting on your best perfume in order to show that you're very sweet with somebody. The focus here is on the burning of incense. Now, what is the function of the burning of incense here? Okay, it's an act of intercession. But it's not a spoken intercession, it's an enacted intercession. Right? It's by doing, he does intercession. You see, what's he doing? He's carrying the people before God, and he's bringing them to God. Okay, so he brings the people to God, the 12 tribes of Israel, on his shoulders. The idea that he carries them, he backs them into God's presence, places them there on his heart. It's wonderful, isn't it? That the people are on his heart. He sympathizes with them. He feels for them. He brings them into God's presence. It's an act of intercession. But it's more than that. That's the one side. Because there's two sides. There's the going in, and then there's coming out. So in intercession, he brings the people in, and what does he bring out from the sanctuary?
God's presence.
All the sweetness of the Lord.
All the sweetness of the Lord. And what's that symbolize, the sweetness of the Lord? God's favor, God's grace, God's approval. God is sweet with his people. He shows that he approves of his people, accepts his people. He's sweet with them, instead of being sour with them, grumpy and angry. So he brings out the sweetness of the Lord into the presence. It's interesting that one of the stock phrases that's used for the burning up of the burnt offering is presented as an aroma that pleases the Lord, or that is sweet to the Lord, or the aroma that gives rest, I'll come to that. There's no reference here that this is an aroma pleasing to God. It's interesting, you'd think that this was offered here to show, you know, to please God. But it's the other way around. The incense burning, so he goes in an act of intercession, that's going out, I mean going in, and coming out he brings aroma. Now people who are close enough here would probably, and we have some accounts in rabbinical literature, that the people could smell the priest before they could see him. That's how powerful that incense was. Can you see how God uses the vision, the nose and sense of smell here to interact with his people, to show his grace to his people? You know, quite literally, I mean, we see ourselves basically, you know, either we stink or we smell sweet. It's a very powerful human bodily interaction. But here it's not so much us towards God, but God towards us. Now, I've taken some time here because incense in the New Testament doesn't just symbolize intercession, but it's also the preaching of the gospel. Is compared by Paul to the spreading of the savour, the sweet savour of incense. And this morning we had incense in chapel, not so much performing an intercessory function as a gospel function. Now this is the place where God is sweet with us. Yes.
Zechariah, John the Baptist's father. And there is some similarity here, and I'm wondering about the place of revelation, because he gets a revelation there, and then also this, it's interesting there, you will have joy and gladness in many ways birth, and so that he can't ask him that. So is there that revelatory function at that spot?
Whether it's actual, whether it's in form of a vision or a prophetic word, or whether it's just in form of the incense is revelatory, it's the disclosure. Disclosing the face of God, not just the presence of God, he could be angry, but to show revealing God's grace. Now, we'll come to the passage where it's quite clear that this is also the place where God speaks to Moses. This is the place where God speaks to Aaron. There are some oracles that Aaron receives from God. Where did he receive these oracles? This is the place. If God wants to speak, this is the normal place for him to speak. To the Moses, first of all, and then to the priests, and through the priests to his people. Now, if you went to Zechariah, John the Baptist, our father, he was the priest on duty that day, and probably the only time in his life when he ever was rostered on. He went in burning the incense, but he came out dumb and unable to give the blessing. I'll come to the blessing in a minute. So we have a high priest, beginning of Luke's gospel, we have a priest on duty who is interrupted and can't finish off the morning burnt offering. Because the people outside praying, he comes out, he can't give the benediction. At the end of Luke's gospel, we have Jesus, the high priest, who ascends into the heavenly sanctuary and brings blessing from heaven to people on earth. So two temples, beginning of Luke, heavenly temple, the end of Luke.
I think it's also telling that Luke tells us that Zechariah and Elizabeth are both direct descendants of Aaron.
Yes, so they aren't just Levites, but they are belong to the high priestly family. Yeah, or any of those details which we overlook, we think, oh, that's just nice information. It's all of theological significance. If any data in the Gospels has theological theological weight. Okay, so the second act. This is the rite of atonement. This is the incense rite. And it is both sacrificial and sacramental at the same time. It's sacrificial and sacramental. There are two faces to it. The third part of the service is the heart and core of it in practical terms. Okay, so the high priest comes out again and he washes his hands and his feet before he mounts up the stairs here and goes onto the altar. Goes Allah, we had that word Allah go up. He goes up to the altar and up on the altar. You have the following sequence of things. The other priests who are on duty there, first of all, hand to him, piece by piece, the parts of the lamb that had been slaughtered. And as far as we can gather, if you think this is the altar here, there's a walk around here. He covers the whole surface of the altar with the parts of the lamb. So you can imagine the head here, leg here, forefoot here. Just if you imagine the whole altar is covered with bits and pieces of the slaughtered lamb. Okay, that's the first thing that's laid on the altar. Okay, it's the coals are there, and then the lamb's placed on the altar. And then the second thing that's placed on the altar is a mixture of flour, fine flour, and olive oil, and incense. Now, fine wheat flour, olive oil, incense. If you put fine wheat flour on fire, what happens?
Acrid.
Okay, it produces smoke, but it's stinking smoke. And it doesn't burn very well, but it produces black smoke. It's good if you want to produce black smoke, that's one way of doing it. So you produce black smoke. If you add olive oil with it, what happens? It'll burn better. Okay, it'll still produce black smoke. But it'll burn better and more quickly instead of slowly. Now, and then you add very pungent incense to it, and what do you have? Instead of a stinking smoke, you've got sweet-smelling smoke. Okay, so he scatters the mixture of flour, olive oil, incense on top of the meat on the coals. Now, you've got to see that people out here don't see any fire. By the time they come, the fire's died down, there's just red hot coals, but nobody sees the red hot coals except the priest who goes on the altar. They're down there, lower level. You put the meat on the coals. Just put yourself and somebody out here. What would you notice? What would you sense? Smell of what? Barbecuing meat. Okay, and if you haven't had meat for 3 months, you can imagine how pleasing that is. And there's fat there. It's a fat animal, so it's fat meat and young lamb. You have the barbecue smell, but it doesn't necessarily produce any smoke. But as soon as you scatter this flour with incense and olive oil on, what will arise at the altar? Okay, there's two things. There'll be a column of smoke. A dark column of smoke will ascend on the altar, and that column of smoke will be not acrid, sour, but it will be sweet. Column of smoke on the altar. Now, there's a technical term which is very important in the ritual tradition, which modern Protestant translations don't reveal. there's a technical term. Quite often, have you noticed there's things about burning up? You know, the burnt offering or the cereal offering, what it got off on the altar. The Hebrew word is kwitter. That's a pial verb. Kwitter is smoke, and the verb from that is to smoke up. So you don't burn up offerings, you smoke up offerings. So you produce smoke, you smoke up offerings to God. The third thing that the priest does in the performance of the burnt offering, the tamid, this part of the tamid, is to pour wine on the altar. Now, it's a little bit uncertain exactly, you know, when this occurred and where it was, but the thing that makes best sense is you have a flagon of wine and you pour it out as a libation on the altar. High alcohol content, what's going to happen to the wine? The flavor. Okay, this is the central part of the ritual. Okay, it's a funny kind of enactment. So, in practical terms, think from the point of view of a layperson here, what happens is that a column of smoke is produced from the altar. Now, what is the function of this? Sorry?
Visibility.
Okay, well, the whole thing is visible. God is doing something through visible means. So he's forgiving, cleansing people through the blood rite. But notice that that act of intercession is done in private. The people don't see this. So they see the blood rite. They don't see the incense rite. But now they see the smoking rite. But column of smoke. And it's a sweet smelling column of smoke produced by the coals, the fiery coals on the altar.
God's gracious
smoke,
presence.
Smoke, does that ring any bells?
God's gracious presence.
What? Okay. Smoke, something else. Does it ring? Smoke, fire, smoke, fire, smoke, fire, smoke. The pillar of smoke and fire. So what is this enacting here? This is an enacted theophany. And you don't see the fire. The fire of God's glory is not revealed, but the fire is there. What you see is the cloud. So the cloud is the glory cloud. Every morning, every evening, a glory cloud which is on the altar, and in that cloud is the fire of God's glory. We'll come to a minute in what God does by his theophany, by his appearance here. Yes?
I'm just curious, when it talks about the pillar of cloud, like at the time of the Exodus,
yes.
Is it that word, the noun derivative, the koter, whatever you said it was, is that the word?
No, it's slightly different. You have the column is the same,
yeah.
Anan, yes. Okay. But this is to produce smoke,
okay.
not a cloud of smoke. Okay? Different word. You would be that. So that's the third. So you get the rite of atonement, the rite of incense, the smoke rite, let's call it. But the smoke rite is a burnt offering because the animal, all the animals burnt on the altar, all the flour and olive oil and wine is burnt on the altar. None of this remains after the act of burning. That's the third enactment. Then after that, as far as we can gather, and this is just the sequencing here, is a little bit in dispute, so I won't go into all the problems. After the smoke has been produced, then the priest comes down from the altar and he stands in front of the altar and delivers the Aaronic benediction. And as he delivers the Aaronic benediction, all the other priests on duty are probably flanked on either side of him. He faces the congregation, lifts up his hands, up to the level of his forehead, and on his forehead you have a plate as part of his headdress, which has some interesting words written on it. Where am I? I'll give you Hebrew first of all. Kovesh le'Adonai. Literally, holiness to the Lord. As the priest goes, performs the service, he bears the name of God, the holy name, on his forehead. And so the name Yahweh is written up here, the holy name. And this is what, it's not just Yahweh by itself, but holiness to the Lord. Now, the Kodesh could mean one of three things, and probably all of three things. It can be a holy thing to the Lord. This is the Lord's property placed up here. The Lord puts his stamp of ownership on the priest and says, holiness to the Lord, this is a holy thing. And then secondly, it can be a holy person, but most commonly, Kodesh is used for holy place. So the priest himself is a walking, talking shrine in person. All of this together. His body is holy for the Lord. He himself is holy for the Lord. He is there. And he is covered with God's holiness. The name is most holy. The name sanctifies him. Now, the name that's on the priest there is up on his forehead. And then just visualize this. You're watching the priest. He lifts up his hands like this, next to that level, and he says, Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. Yahweh look on you with favor or lift up his face upon you and give you peace. And according to Numbers, it says when the priest does this, he places the name of God on the people. You see it quite literally? The name of God, which is on his forehead, the name of God, which is located in the temple, we spoke about that, the tabernacle, the name of God, which replaces the idol, is placed on the people in the benediction. And then Numbers goes on, and you will place my name on the people, and I will bless them. So the benediction communicates God's blessing. If you like, this is the culmination. It's not the end of the divine service, but the culmination of the divine service. Everything that's happened beforehand leads up to the Aaronic benediction. Or what's the purpose of all this that happens beforehand? Is so that God's name can be put on his people and God can give his blessing to his people. Now, what does it mean when they leave the temple? They carry the name of God with them and they carry the blessing of God with them. And if the name of God has been placed on them, what does that name make them? Holy. They are sanctuary men, holy men and women, carrying the name of God from the temple out into their homes and villages and farmsteads. Lastly, okay, that's the main part of the ritual, but in connection with this, the priests also offered their personal grain offering or cereal offering. A part of it was given to God, the rest of it belonged to them as their daily ration from God. So part of it is you have very good flour mixed with olive oil, and that's offered to God. The incense is only burnt. So the leftover flour and olive oil is baked into bread and then they eat it as their midday meal in this area. Now, can you work out what the status of that bread is? It's not just holy, it's most holy. It can only be eaten there by the most holy people, who are the priests. So the daily offering culminates in a priestly meal in which the priests eat the holy bread from the table of God. They are God's courtiers, they are God's servants, they work together with God. God gives them their daily ration of holy food for them to, in reward if you like, or for them to serve him as priests. Okay, can I take you through again the main parts of the daily service? You have the rite of atonement. You have the incense burning. You have the smoking up of the offerings. You have the benediction. And then you have the holy meal. Any questions on that? Does that make sense? And can you see both resemblances and yet differences between this and our divine service? Yes?
They do this 7 days a week?
7 days a week, yes.
And
on the Sabbath day, instead of offering one lamb, you offer two lambs.
Okay.
And then on festival occasions, you offer even more.
So then they get a double portion of bread.
That's right. And so you don't just have a daily ration, but you have a feast ration. And then I won't go into all the other offerings, because then the meat comes in too. And in fact, any priest on duty, the diet would be a very, very high value, because they have very high protein, and they eat, their diet basically is meat. So they have bread, olive oil, meat. Yes?
In Joel 2, and then Peter quotes it, blood, fire, and column of smoke.
Yes.
Any allusion there?
Yes, some scholars try and draw a connection. I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
I won't go further. Yes?
Do the people eat the meat?
Yes, not of the public offering. Now, see, remember right at the beginning I said there's two classes of offerings. There are the offerings, the national offerings, the community offerings, the public offerings. Whether people are present or not, the morning tamid and the evening tamid is presented to God on the altar. And every morning, every evening, the offerings end then with a meal, a priestly meal. Not a meal for the lay people, it's a meal for the priest. Now, the whole purpose of lay people coming to the temple is to have a meal with God. Meal with God. God is the host. They are the guests. They eat holy meat and holy bread, and they drink holy wine from the Lord's table. So when you come to look at the personal offerings, the main personal offering is the peace offering and the cereal offering. So lay people bring bread offerings and meat offerings, and only a small portion of that's given to God and the priest. The rest of it is for them to eat and to drink in the presence of God. Is that clear? So you can say in practical terms, if I'm an Israelite and I'm going up to Jerusalem, I'll talk about Jerusalem rather than here in the desert, because it's clear that I go up to Jerusalem for the great festival. This is a time of feasting. I go up to do for the following purposes. Number one, since God is the owner of the land, I'm bringing my annual rent for the land. This is an offering, a token of saying, okay, this is not my land. I am a share farmer on the land. The land belongs to God, and this is my rent for the land, acknowledging that God's the owner of the land. Number one. Number two, you go in order to have a meal, and not just any meal, but the best possible meal, meat and the best bread, the best wine, know, your Barossa Valley Australian Shiraz rather than Napa Valley Plonk. I'm having a dig here. best possible wine. And you eat and drink and rejoice in God's presence. And the third purpose for going down to the temple is for you to receive blessing. Not just there, but to receive blessing from God and carry the blessings home. On the one hand, as God has blessed you, you bring offerings to God. And then from the sanctuary, you bring the blessing of God from God's presence to your home, to your farm, to your animals, to your families, to your communities. So you go in order to receive blessing. The fourth reason to go there is to share God's holiness in practical terms. That's looking at it from the lay angle rather than from the priest's angle. Any other questions? Yes?
I just want to make sure I'm not confused.
Oh, I'm sure you're confused.
I'm sure
I'm confused.
Not any more
myself.
Confused than I already am.
But okay,
the holy meal that the priests eat for, okay, since there's the AM and the PM.
Yes.
So is there the holy meal at midday and then a holy meal?
There's some dispute, and I don't know what your opinion is, but we've had arguments about this. Was the priestly offering just, did they eat it just in the morning, or did they eat it also in the evening?
It's my opinion that it was twice.
Okay, that's my opinion. But I know there's some scholars that say it's just basically sort of their midday meal, and so they have breakfast maybe at home or elsewhere, and they have supper. But I think it is both morning and evening.
Now,
yes?
Can I ask another question?
Of course you can. And whether I give you permission or not, you will.
Okay.
Yes.
I know that obviously this divine service was only for God in God's land at the tabernacle or
the
temple.
No, it begins already out there in the desert.
Well, okay, it begins in the desert.
Yes, but in its fullest extent. The full service could only be enacted once they got in the land. And you notice quite often you can see it. When you come into the land then.
Okay. So my question is, now Daniel obviously is not in the land.
That's right.
But he is at least observing the morning and the evening
times. And midday prayers.
Prayers.
Yep.
Now you said that there was no spoken word at the altar of incense. Can we be sure of that? Because Daniel prays at the hour of incense, it said,
okay.
And he confesses his sins and the sins of his people, and then Gabriel appears, and it would seem to me that for someone conducting the liturgy like a Zechariah,
yes.
That it would be a strong sense of deja vu if he knows the scriptures. I'm sure he's aware of Daniel. You know, that here now, because he's praying for forgiveness and the salvation and so forth of Israel, and that the Lord has heard your prayer is not, you're going to have a poopsie as much as it is the enactment of the salvation plan.
I've got your question.
Okay.
Notice there's a difference between what is divinely instituted and what's adiaphora. Now, there are two answers that I'll care to make to your question. Number one, it's quite clear that at least at the time of the exile, which means if Daniel does it in the exile, it's already before the exile, it was the custom of the people. Take this away, and you have the people out here. They see the priest going in here, and what do the people do then?
They pray.
They pray. And you can see that with Daniel, but more clearly in the story at the beginning of Luke, what are the people doing as Zechariah is in the Holy of Holies? They are praying. This is the time for personal prayer. It's not public prayer. There's not much, you know, like we had this morning, we have public intercession, Caesarea prayer. It's a space for personal prayer. Okay? Secondly, and this is one thing that is different about the tabernacle and the temple, you may remember or may not remember that the great liturgical innovation of David and Solomon was the institution of the Levitical choir. The Levitical choir, who sang the Psalms. Yeah, I better show you. Who sang the Psalms as the burnt offering was placed on the altar. Now we come into the temple, a much larger arrangement. And I won't try and do it in scale. I don't have time to do it exactly. We'll do it very roughly. Outer court. This is the so-called court of the women.
Is this Solomon's?
This is Solomon's temple. Okay. And then you have the temple proper, a much larger building here. Holy of Holies, holy place, porch. And you have a huge, and I mean a humongous altar here in front of the temple. And instead of just one laver, you have 12 lavers somewhere here. I've got six there like that. Now, there are 15, this is 15 steps lower than this. This is higher up. So you enter at a lower level, like down the hill here, and then you go up. There's 15 steps corresponding to the 15 Psalms of Ascent, and you come up into the sanctuary. Now, every morning, every evening, as the burnt offering is smoked up from the altar, the Levitical choir, which stands in, which is on the platform here at the top of the steps, sings the daily psalm, and sings psalms which are both thanksgiving and praise, as well as petitionary prayer. So this is the place of petitionary prayer, from and public petitionary prayer, public intercession in the divine service. This is where it comes in, together with the burnt offering. There's three things that happen together. The burnt offering is placed on the altar. The choir sings the psalm each day towards the congregation. And then at the particular moments, the congregation prostrates itself. The congregation worships. There you get that word worship again, which means prostration. So at the beginning and end of the psalm, and at the end of every verse in the psalm, probably in those Selah passages, you have the cymbals clashing, and the people prostrate themselves. Now that's the time of prayer. But this is instituted by David and implemented by Solomon at the command of the Lord, through the prophets Nathan and Gad. You find all about this in the book of Chronicles, and you can read about this in my doctoral dissertation, which is published, The Lord's Song, The Basis, Function, and Significance of Choral Music and Chronicles. Now, I haven't checked whether there's a copy available there in the bookshop. Okay. Yes.
So in Solomon's temple, the altar of burnt offering moves
closer to the people.
Moves further away from the people, doesn't it?
Well, it depends, because you've got to accommodate a lot more people.
Okay.
So in a sense, it's further, but it's also raised higher. So you can, if you think in terms of sight line, okay. People, there's walls here. This is the entrance here, big entrance. You come in here. What's the thing that catches your eye first and foremost? It's the altar. And then above the altar, you have the pillars, the pillars of the temple, the two big pillars. If you like, looking at from the congregational point of view, you have the altar here, and then you get the pillars there, and then you then behind them you have the temple proper. But it's been designed in such a way that one thing is highlighted above all else, and that is the altar. So even though technically it's further from the people, in terms of sightline, visibility, it's made even more available to the people. And then when you get, this is very high, and then they can see the priest as he goes around the steps here on the side. He goes as a boardwalk around the edge, and the people out here can see the priest putting the stuff on the altar, and they can very clearly see the column of smoke which arises, and that column of smoke is framed by those two pillars in terms of, okay? So the pillars in front of the temple, the smoke there rises between the two pillars to the sky. And then secondly, what makes it visible, what this is designed to do, is to make more visible and to see more clearly the priest when he stands in front of the altar here and delivers the Aaronic benediction. Because as far as we can gather, the singers step aside so that all the congregation assembled out here can see the priest as well as hear the priest when he delivers the benediction. Okay, we didn't get very far, did we? Okay, let's go to my